The following talk is from St. Michael's Fulwell, a gospel-centered community for Fulwell, Teddington, and beyond. Our passion is to see every life following Jesus. For more information, visit our website, stmichaelsfulwell.co.uk.
We're going to turn to the Bible now. So do grab a Bible nearby and turn to page 1015. We're going to be reading from Mark chapter 11, verses 1 to 11. And Sandy's going to come and preach in a few moments. And some handouts are coming out as well now. But turn to page 1015, Mark 11, and Claire is going to come and read that for us.
As they approached Jerusalem and came to Bethphage and Bethany at the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go to the village ahead of you, and just as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there, which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, 'Why are you doing this?' say, 'The Lord needs it, and will send it back here shortly.' They went and found a colt outside in the street, tied at a doorway. As they untied it, some people standing there asked, 'What are you doing, untying that colt?' They answered as Jesus had told them to, and the people let them go. When they brought the colt to Jesus and threw their cloaks over it, he sat on it. Many people spread their cloaks on the road, while others spread branches they had cut in the fields. Those who went ahead and those who followed shouted, 'Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David. Hosanna in the highest heaven.' Jesus entered Jerusalem and went into the temple courts. He looked around at everything, but since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12.
Thank you, Claire. Good morning, everyone. We have a one-word title this morning, which is humbled. And then on Friday, we have one word, crucified. Next Sunday, risen. And the Sunday after that, ascended. Humbled, crucified, risen, ascended. And that sequence is a reminder of a great spiritual law, which Jesus expresses like this: all those who exalt themselves will be humbled. It's about to appear on the screen. And those who humble themselves will be exalted. In other words, in the Christian life, the way up is down. If, like Jesus, you humble yourself, you will be exalted. So I want to come at it in a slightly unusual way this morning. First, to think about what happened on Palm Sunday, Jesus' humble entry into Jerusalem, and then to reflect on what that means for us, using as an example, a kind of worked example, the story of Moses. How does that same pattern of humility, followed by exaltation, of dying and then rising, of suffering and then glory, play out in Moses' life and also in ours? Jesus and his disciples were coming to Jerusalem at Passover to remember the first Exodus, that foundational rescue story of the Old Testament centering on the death of a lamb to save each household. And it foreshadows the foundational rescue story of the New Testament, which is the death of the lamb to save the people. When Moses unexpectedly turns up at the Transfiguration, Luke tells us that Jesus spoke about his own exodus, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. So we're meant to see the parallels between the exodus, the first exodus, and the cross. And so if we look at how God humbled Moses and then mightily used him, then we will learn about how God might use us. So let's start by thinking about Jesus on Palm Sunday. He and his disciples have come up from Jericho, the lowest city on the planet, 800 feet below sea level, to Jerusalem, almost 3,000 feet above sea level. And at the end of this long climb, you see the great city on a hill and its magnificent temple built of white marble. Josephus described it as like a mountain of snow glinting in the sunlight. Millions of pilgrims every year walked up the hill to that city for Passover. But Jesus suddenly switches from walking to riding. He gives very precise instructions so that anyone who is paying attention knows that something of real significance is happening. Jesus is making here a profound symbolic statement by riding in for this final climactic entry to Jerusalem. Let me read verse 2 of Mark 11. He sends the two disciples saying, "Go to the village ahead of you, and just as you enter it, you will find a colt tied there which no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here." And that, of course, echoes the prophecy in Zechariah, which Toby mentioned. Just flip back with me to page 955. Zechariah is the second last book of the Old Testament. Page 955, and we'll just read that central prophecy. Chapter 9, verse 9, under the heading, "The Coming of Zion's King." Zion is Jerusalem. Zechariah 9, verse 9, page 955. "Rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. Shout, daughter Jerusalem. See, your king comes to you, righteous and victorious, lowly, and riding on a donkey, on a colt, the foal of a donkey. I will take away the chariots from Ephraim and the war horses from Jerusalem, and the battle bow will be broken. He will proclaim peace to the nations. His rule will extend from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth." Jesus is very carefully, deliberately fulfilling this great prophecy about the arrival of a king who will rule the world from sea to sea. And the bit about no one has ever ridden it before is probably because when something was used for a special sacred purpose, it shouldn't have previously been used for something everyday or ordinary. So this is a kind of new, unused donkey. Everyone who's alert and is watching this knows that this is not just another of the millions of pilgrims who come to Jerusalem every year for Passover. It's not just another visit by Jesus to Jerusalem. We know he did come to Jerusalem from time to time, particularly from John's gospel. But this is different. This is the final fulfillment. Your king comes to you righteous and victorious. He's coming to win the victory, to bring the second exodus, the rescue of his people. So it is triumphant, and yet at the same time, it's paradoxically humble. Zechariah says he comes not only righteous and victorious, but also lowly and riding on a donkey. Someone called a donkey a steed fit for a child or a hobbit. This is not the mighty conqueror coming to smite his enemies. It's not Attila the Hun entering Rome. It's not Malachi chapter 3, who can stand the day of the Lord's appearing. The only smiting he does is a symbolic one of a fig tree. He overturns the tables of the money changers in the temple, but no doubt they waited 10 minutes till he'd gone around the corner and then set them all up again. As Andrew Wilson puts it, he came not to wash in the blood of his enemies, but to wash the feet of his friends. So it is both dramatic and understated, both triumphant and humble. People do recognize something special is happening. They spread cloaks and cut branches on the road as you would do for a royal procession. They quote a great messianic psalm, Psalm 118, "Hosanna, save us, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." But in Mark, at least, they stop short of actually acclaiming Jesus as Messiah. They don't call him the son of David. They just say in verse 10 of Mark 11, "Blessed is the coming kingdom of our father David." Is he the Messiah? Are they not quite sure? There's no mention of the Roman authorities getting involved or even noticing. And what do you think of verse 11? Is it an anticlimax? When you first read Mark's gospel, you think it's very simple. And then the more you read it, the more you realize how subtle it is. So let me read you verse 11. Jesus entered Jerusalem and went into the temple courts. He looked around at everything, but since it was already late, he went out to Bethany with the 12. Is that a great triumphal entry, or is it a bit of a disappointment? The crowd seems to have quite quickly disappeared, and Jesus doesn't even spend the night in Jerusalem, but like an ordinary pilgrim at this overcrowded time, he goes out to a nearby village. He looked around at everything and went out to Bethany. Is that it? This is pure speculation, but maybe at this point Judas thought to himself, what? I gave up everything for this? A donkey and a few branches? I've had enough. I'm going to the chief priests. This humble entry to Jerusalem is a bit like the whole of Jesus' ministry. If you get it, it is wonderful and beautiful. But it can seem disappointing. It's not hard to miss what's going on. Let me give you another example of that, Jesus' parables. If you get them, they're profound, brilliant insights into the mysteries of human existence and of the kingdom of heaven. But for many people, they're just a bunch of dull stories about seeds and sheep. What was he on about? They're both ordinary and extraordinary. Pascal, the great French polymath, talked of a hidden God. He said this: God has given us enough light to find him and left us enough darkness not to. And he also said God hides himself from those who test him, but reveals himself to those who seek him. Well, I think this is a good example of that. Jesus' entry to Jerusalem both reveals and conceals the coming of the kingdom. And that is the humility of our Creator, who said, I'm gentle and humble of heart. He never forces himself on us. He never overwhelms us. The evidence is there, but we have to seek it. And this beautiful humility of our Creator is not something we can just understand intellectually. We also need to live it out and experience it and wrestle with it over the whole of our lives. And in the time left, I'd like us to look as an example of that at the life of Moses at the time of the first Exodus, and then relate that to how God might use us. I guess pretty much everyone knows something about Moses from Sunday school, from sermons, or from the film The Prince of Egypt. He's known as the founder of the Jewish religion and of the whole nation of Israel. He wrote down the Ten Commandments. He composed, we think, most of the first five books of the Bible, and he's undoubtedly one of the key figures in human history. Sigmund Freud, who was Jewish, wrote a book called Moses and Monotheism. And in it, he claimed that Moses invented the whole idea of monotheism, leading to the three great Abrahamic faiths, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. I don't think Freud was right about that, but it gives you a sense of how influential Moses' life was. But when you look at the events of that life, well, they're unusual. Let's just remind ourselves of some of them. His name Moses means to draw out, because he was taken out of the River Nile by Pharaoh's daughter, who'd found him in what we now call a Moses basket. His mother had put him there to try and keep him safe from the Egyptian death squads. And that rescue meant instead of being killed, he was brought up in the Egyptian royal family, educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, the New Testament tells us. Probably the finest education system in the world at that time. He spoke their language. He was one of them, a prince of Egypt, an insider. And you might think that meant he was perfectly placed to rescue his people from slavery. He was in his prime, 40 years old, right at the heart of the action, very influential. But at that point, it all goes disastrously wrong. He sees one of his people being beaten up, and he kills the Egyptian doing it. He thinks this is the beginning of the revolution, but in fact he's soon in trouble. Someone's seen him, and he's on the run, a wanted man. He fled far away to a distant land and got a job looking after small, helpless creatures who keep getting themselves in trouble. Not a primary school teacher, a shepherd. And he did that for another 40 years. An ordinary, unnoticed job. So by this point, he's around 80. He's an old man. All his hopes, it seems, have come to nothing. He called his eldest son Gershom, which means alien. "I'm a stranger in a strange land," he said, meaning my life has been wasted. So God has humbled Moses, taken away all his worldly strengths and advantages. And at that point, out in the desert, Moses noticed a bush on fire that didn't seem to burn up. He went over to have a look, and suddenly the Creator speaks to him from the fire. "Moses, Moses, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to tell him to let my people go." A forgotten 80-year-old in the middle of nowhere, whose life has been a failure, is God's choice to confront the most powerful man in the world. That's a strange choice, isn't it? Certainly Moses thinks so. "Who am I," he says, "that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And over two chapters, Exodus 3 and 4, Moses gives God a whole series of reasons why God has made the wrong choice. We see that failure has changed Moses. The brash, self-confident young prince of Egypt has had the stuffing knocked out of him by life's disappointments. Just go back to Exodus chapter 4, page 60. Page 60. And I'll read verse 1 of chapter 4. "Moses answered, 'What if they don't believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you?' I'm not the kind of person that people listen to," Moses thinks. And then in verse 10, Moses said to the Lord, "Pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue." That's literally heavy of mouth. And the culmination of Moses' reluctance is in verse 13. "But Moses said, 'Pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else. Please send someone else.'" Interesting to contrast that with the DreamWorks movie, which is all about how Moses got angry at the oppression of his people and seized the initiative and set out boldly to rescue them. That's not what happened. In the real story, Moses does everything he can to avoid getting involved. All the initiative comes from God. So our one-word title this morning is humbled. Moses has truly been humbled by failure. God has taken away all his power and position. But now, God can use him. And let's look at how the Lord responds to Moses when Moses says, "I've got nothing to offer, please send someone else." God doesn't say what we would say. "Of course you can do it, Moses. Believe in yourself." He never promises to take away Moses' weaknesses. He doesn't tell him the task is easier than it looks. Instead, again and again, he just tells Moses to trust him. And the first time we see that is in chapter 3, verse 11, near the top of page 60. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you." That's the point. Not "you can do it, Moses," but "I will be with you." God gives him three miraculous signs of his presence. A staff that becomes a snake. Snakes were symbols of the power of Egypt. Egyptian pharaohs used to wear a crown with a snake with a raised hood in the front of it, threatening their enemies. And then a hand that is healed of leprosy. Leprosy was a deadly, incurable disease in Egypt. And then water from the Nile that turns to blood. The Nile was the lifeblood of the whole nation. It was utterly dependent on the fertility of the great river. And so God is saying by these three signs, I'm in control of all these things, of Egyptian power, of the diseases that destroy Egypt and the river that gives it life. And I am with you. All you have to do is be humble and trust me. And it's just worth noticing what God says to Moses in verse 11. When Moses says, I'm slow of speech and tongue, God answers, who gave human beings their mouths? Who enables them to speak? Is it not I, the Lord? Who gave you your mouth? We often think in some areas of our lives, well, this is my real strength. I'm really quite good at this. I'm very gifted. But the word gives it away, doesn't it? Because even our best attributes are gifts. They're things that are given to us. We're so foolish to be arrogant about them. What we really need to do is to trust the God who is so patient and gentle with us. Even when Moses says, please send someone else, although God is exasperated, he doesn't give up on him. He gently works with him and encourages him. Your brother Aaron is already on the way. He will speak for you. I will help both of you to speak and will teach you what to do. All Moses needs to do to become one of the most famous people in the history of the world is to trust those words that God says to him, I will be with you. At a crucial time in South Africa, shortly before Nelson Mandela was released, the crowd in Johannesburg were denied permission to demonstrate, and they gathered furious around the Anglican Cathedral. Violence seemed inevitable. The riot police were in full armor, the guard dogs were snarling, and a tiny figure went into the pulpit, Desmond Tutu. The state and their forces have great power, he said, but they've picked a fight with God, a fight no human can win. You policemen have already lost. We're inviting you to join the winning side. That is pretty much what Moses is going to say to Pharaoh. It doesn't matter how powerful you are. If you pick a fight with God, you have already lost. I will be with you. So to save his people, God didn't use a confident mover and shaker with the inside track on the Egyptian royal family. He used an over-the-hill, hesitant outsider. A man, Numbers tells us, who is more humble than anyone else on the face of the earth. I don't think that's an exaggeration. I think Moses genuinely knew this wasn't about him. He had been humbled, and that's why he was ready to change the world. What does this teach us? Well, I suggest that the way God dealt with Moses is the way he deals with us. He doesn't tell Moses to think positive or believe in himself. He doesn't tell him it's not that difficult or guarantee immediate success. In fact, most of what Moses does in the early stages seems to make things worse. God simply says to Moses, I am with you. Someone said Moses spent 40 years thinking he was a somebody, 40 years realizing he was a nobody, and then the rest of his life seeing what God could do with somebody who realizes they're a nobody. The rest of his life seeing what God could do with somebody who realizes they're a nobody. As the story goes on, Moses starts to develop an astonishing assurance, a quiet confidence, not in himself, but in the Lord who is with him. Alec Mattia says this in his commentary. Moses had learned his lesson well. He at last settled down to obey the word of God and was consequently the master of every situation. Walking in obedience, Moses, the despondent failure, became increasingly and progressively the authoritative and victorious agent of the Lord and the master of Pharaoh. That's what it means to be humbled. It gives us an extraordinary assurance because it's not about us. It's about trusting the Lord who works always not through power, but through weakness. And of course, that's how Jesus came into the world, isn't it? As an outsider, born in poverty, no room at the inn, no possessions or power, entering Jerusalem on a borrowed donkey, dying broken outside the city. But that was the second Exodus, God's plan to rescue us from an even more deadly enemy than Pharaoh, from death itself. God doesn't work through great displays of power, but through gentleness and weakness. So what about us? If you're a Christian believer, you're called to serve. Probably doesn't matter very much whether you're a bus driver or a vicar, whether you're paid or unpaid, whether you're a member of the royal family or a peasant, all of us are called to serve. And as he does with Moses, God will very gently, patiently work with you and give you what you need. I will be with you. He uses us not when we think we're wonderful and powerful, but when we're humble and trusting. Martin Luther said, "If you're not yet nothing, God cannot make something out of you." If you're not yet nothing, God cannot make something out of you. If you will allow me to speculate for a moment, a second time, maybe God did use Moses' advantages. Maybe it helped him that he was brought up in the royal family, that he was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. But that wasn't what really mattered. First, Moses had to grasp this rescue was God's work. It wasn't about him. That's how God rescued his people from Egypt. It's how he rescues us on the cross, and it's how he uses us now. Through humility and weakness, whoever humbles themselves will be exalted. Well, I'm almost done, but three very quick final thoughts for you to reflect on. There may be other things that occur to you, but here are three. One, failure may be one of the most important things and one of the most valuable things that ever happens to you. Don't despair when you fail. Instead, ask yourself, what is the Lord teaching me here that I can't learn in any other way? Two, God is never through with you. Whatever age and stage you are, no matter how unsuccessful you might seem to be in the world's eyes, God can use you in new ways, surprising ways that you haven't thought of. In fact, maybe this is when he can really use you for the first time. It's never too late. He never gives up on you. And thirdly, when things go wrong in our lives, maybe it is more often through our strengths than our weaknesses. The areas in which we think, I'm really good at this, I've got this. That's when we need to be careful. We can very easily go spiritually astray. That's why Paul says in 2 Corinthians, I delight in my weaknesses, for where I am weak, then I'm strong. So beware of your strengths and rejoice in your weaknesses. That's what it means to be humbled. On Palm Sunday, as we think about Jesus humble and riding on a donkey, let's also reflect on our own lives. What is God teaching me through the ups and particularly the downs of my life? Am I humble enough to be really useful? If you're not yet nothing, God cannot make something out of you.